Well, good morning, TNC family, from my home to wherever you are on this fourth Sunday in August. Let's pray together as we begin, and I want to pray with you the prayer of the psalmist from Psalm chapter 113. Let the name of the Lord be praised, both now and forevermore, from the rising of the sun to the place where it sets. For our God is higher than anything and anyone, and filled with love and compassion for all that he has made. He raises the poor from the dust and helps all those in need. O God, may we know the beauty of this power, presence, and love today. Amen. Last week, we explored the question, what's the upside? And specifically, we talked from the scriptures about three things we often do, but that have very little upside. Today, however, I want to teach from the scriptures on the opposite problem. Not things I do that have little upside, but rather things I don't do, but I should, because they have very little downside. The classic biblical story, of course, is Naaman in 2 Kings chapter 5. Naaman is the commander of the army of the king of Aram, and he's a rich and powerful man, but then one day he gets leprosy, the bacterial infection that will most certainly cost him his life. And so he goes to the prophet of God, Elisha, who tells him that he can be healed if he just dips into the Jordan River 7 times. Verse 10, go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleansed. Verse 11, but Naaman went away angry and said, I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the spot, and cure me of my leprosy. Plus, Naaman goes on, are not the rivers of Damascus better than all the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed instead of the Jordan? So he turned and went off in a rage, at which point Naaman's servants go to him and say, sir, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? Why not just go down to the Jordan River, jump in, wash, and be cleansed? What's the downside? They say, there is none. But the upside is enormous, healing from a death sentence. And Naaman, of course, finally does come to his senses, dips himself in the Jordan River 7 times, and his flesh is restored. And the question that helped him come to his senses was, what's the downside? A question that is actually embedded in story after story throughout the scriptures. Queen Esther, for example, in chapter 4 of the book with her name, considers the downside of going to the king and says, worst case scenario, downside, I perish. But if I perish, I perish, because that's a small downside compared to saving a nation. And what I want you to notice, TNC, is she is actually considering the downside, as does the prophet Daniel, upon hearing the news that a new law will restrict his right to pray. He considers the downside of ignoring the law, a night with the lions, and says, if that's the only downside, I'm going to open the east window and pray to my God. Now, what's the downside doesn't actually feel like an obvious question immersed in the scriptures, but it turns out it actually gets asked quite a lot. And there are times when it is, in fact, the most practical, God-honoring, and life-instructing question we can ask. I mean, think of the story of the prodigal son in Luke chapter 15, the kid who is starving in a pigsty. The motivating question that leads to forgiveness, restoration, and renewed relationship, the motivating question he asks himself is, What's the downside in returning to my father and begging his forgiveness? And it's the same case with the sower in Jesus' story, who after a vandalizer plants weeds among his crops, decides that the downside of trying to remove the weeds now is greater than just letting the weeds grow up alongside his good crops. What's the downside is his determining question. And it's the same in Acts chapter 5 when Gamaliel convinces the Sanhedrin to let the apostles live. No downside, he says. And I could go on and on because it turns out that the question driving dozens and dozens of really good decisions in the scriptures and in our lives today is the simple question, what's the downside? And if you determine it's actually very little in comparison to the upside, then that reality ought to drive you toward the better action. And so today, I want to talk to you about downside, and specifically ask you to think with me about the question, what's the downside of three activities that the Bible talks a lot about? So here we go. Here's number one. Number one, what's the downside of being more flexible? Here's what I mean. Not long ago, I read alongside a group of 10 folks the book by Bonnie Christian called Flexible Faith, Rethinking What It Means to Follow Jesus Today. And in the book, she tackles 17 topics from the Bible to the Trinity to baptism to prayer to the end of the world. 17 topics, and with each one, she outlines the historic movements, shifts from one position to another on these topics, as well as the current differing opinions that exist today surrounding these 17 topics. Opinions from the Far East, which are different than the ones in Africa, different from the ones in South America, different from dozens and dozens of denominations within America. And then she writes early in the book, quote, "My first working title for this book was actually 200 million ways to follow Jesus, because it's a rough calculation of how many different combinations of beliefs any Christian could select from the options I present for all 17 topics." And her argument, of course, is for a more flexible faith, which she says leads to collaboration and dialogue and inclusion and grace. And also, now listen, also places you in the best position to discover new truth because you're flexible and not locked into one way of thinking when new information comes, which is what we need today in our culture more than ever. And not just in the realm of theology, but in our public discourse too, because new information is coming to us all the time. Because what was true 10 years ago may have been true 10 years ago, but is no longer true today. Because no matter what area of knowledge you pick, the half-life of any subject, physics, biology, archaeology, cosmology, computer science, you name it, the half-life of any subject is getting shorter and shorter and shorter, meaning one's information base can be wrong in a hurry. In the field of just biblical studies, for example, in recent decades, over 1 million cuneiform texts, as well as uncounted reliefs, tomb paintings, and papyri have been discovered, revealing the ancient world to us in brand new ways, which means, importantly, the world of Jesus. And we have good new editions of dozens of once hard-to-find Jewish texts and a whole new array of literature about them. And we have all kinds of archaeological finds, which means we need to not only be flexible, but humble. And it's obviously not just in how we think and talk about the Bible. It's in everything we need to be flexible and humble, because there are hundreds and hundreds of fields that require knowledge. And you might be an expert on one or two or even three fields, but expertise in one area means very little in another. In fact, the more of an expert you are in one field, the more you should know about how much there is to know about a subject, how long it took you to become an expert, and therefore all that you don't know about other subjects. So it's not likely that you can be an expert on music and computers and sales and public speaking and relationships and investing and design and home repair all at once. And even within a field, hang with me, just because you're an expert in 18th century European history, for example, doesn't mean you know about first century Japanese history. Just because you're a Hall of Fame third baseman doesn't mean you'll be a successful team manager. Just because you're an incredible brain surgeon doesn't mean you would be an incredible politician. And so on. Now, will you give me a little grace for 1 second? Because I want to point out something in American discourse that might sound judgmental at first, but I don't mean it to be in a negative way. Too many people think that they're an expert on stuff that they've put zero time into. Like, I'm not really interested in your COVID opinion, YouTube doctor, if you're not a real doctor or a scientist or an epidemiologist. And folks, don't watch one YouTube video and a few hours of political TV and think you're an expert on climate change. I mean, if you're not a climatologist or quoting a climatologist, then be more quiet. Listen more. Because you don't know more than a successful insurance actuary or underwriter about risks and costs and expenses for that item or activity. You know, it used to be that if you did something for a long time, studied it, was paid for it, had a track record for practicing it for years and being affirmed by peers, that you were actually considered an expert, no matter the field. Education, landscaping, music, biblical exegesis. Like, that qualifies you to be listened to with more seriousness than somebody who's not. But for some reason, in America now, social media has empowered people to think they know more about technology than Elon Musk, or business than Richard Branson, or public health than Lena Wen. Because they can send me a link to some obscure website hosted by some anonymous person from the basement in their parents' house. Now listen, it's fine to have opinions, humble opinions. But when you and I have an opinion, we need to be very, very flexible and willing to change when new information comes our way. As Adam Grant, Wharton's top-rated professor, writes in his new amazing book called Think Again, he says the more of an expert you are in any field, the more flexible you actually are. That's right. The smarter you are and the more successful you are, the more you are constantly adapting your beliefs and behaviors. Quote, the single most important driver of success is how often you update your beliefs. A process of becoming less wrong than before. Great thinkers, he says, don't boast about how much they know. They marvel at how little they understand, which means they're flexible. Why? Because there is just hardly any downside. Which is why I think the Apostle Paul was so good at keeping the main thing, and then just being flexible about everything else. You'll remember he writes quite famously in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, to the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all people so that by all means possible, I might save some. And in one of Jesus' greatest teachings, he scolds the religious folks for failing to be flexible and updating their beliefs when new information comes on the scene. New wine must go in new wineskins, he says, and there's going to always be new wine coming your way. TNC, this is going to help you so much in your life, at home, at work, in your recreation. There's just little downside to being more flexible. Something I was reminded of 10 days ago when the White Sox and Yankees played the highest-rated regular season baseball game in 16 years in the middle of a cornfield based on the 1989 movie Field of Dreams. And if you watched it, then Kevin Costner was there. You saw that. And it was so fun. It looked like a minor league baseball game or a rec league game in the coolest stadium ever. And it was great for movie lovers and the movie industry, great for the corn industry, great for baseball, great for the White Sox and the Yankees, and for television ratings and advertisers. And everybody won because baseball was flexible, open to a new idea, lightening up a little bit, getting out of its comfort zone, which is a great lesson for us. Be less irritable about new ideas. Wake up with the idea that you might change something today, because there's just very little downside to being more flexible. An idea that permeates the scriptures. Okay, number two, second question. What's the downside of being more generous? Like, seriously, think about your current level of generosity, say with your money first and then with your time second. And then maybe give yourself a quick rating on a scale of 1 to 10. 1 being you were the stingiest person you've ever met, and 10 being you couldn't be more generous if you tried. Rate yourself quickly in your head. And now ask yourself, if you were more generous than you are now, what would be the downside? See, I think you might actually be surprised at how seldom folks ask this question. And yet, we often think of the downside of other things related to our money and time. Like, I was talking with a neighbor a couple weeks ago, and he said to me, "You know, David, because of all that's going on in our country with the virus and travel and the economy, I haven't had a vacation in like over a year, and I need a vacation." In other words, he was clear on the downside he was experiencing having not taken a vacation in the last 12 months, which is actually a good thing to be aware of. And many folks are consciously aware of the downside of not saving enough money, like in their reserve accounts. I mean, I hear folks all the time say, "I need to be saving more for my retirement," or, "I probably should have a little silo account for my next car, and a little silo account for retirement, and a little silo account for an emergency, flat tire, broken hot water heater, and so on. And a little silo for my next summer vacation, and a silo account for birthdays and Christmas gifts." Now, TNC, the truth is that would be very wise, because we all know the downside of having a car or a refrigerator or an air conditioning unit that functions poorly. We all understand the downside of not having enough money for ourselves, which is why we all think often about the downside of not having enough for ourselves. But the question is, how often do you think of the downside of not being more generous with others? Because Jesus tells a brilliant story about this, recorded in Luke chapter 12, verse 16. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Verse 18, then he said, "This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, now you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Verse 20. Just then God showed up and said, fool, tonight you are going to die, and your barn full of goods, who will get it? Verse 21. And that's what happens when you fill your barn with self and not with God. Now, I think the problem for this man might be that he never asks the question, what's the downside of my silos? And don't get me wrong, I'm all about selfies and self-image and affirming the new self-made generation that reads more self-help books than ever so that we can have more self-esteem. But some of today's language around personal discovery, personal growth, and self-care, I think has become a mask for self-love and self-obsession at the expense of being generous toward others. And I just wonder, have you asked the question recently, what's the downside if I was to be more generous? Because I propose to you, it's virtually nothing. In fact, it's almost all upside. Even Dave Ramsey says, in perhaps the best-selling financial management book of all time, The Complete Money Makeover, that one of the best ways to get out of your debt is to start giving to others. That's right. Part of the strategy for getting out of debt is to start parting with money in a way that prioritizes generosity over acquisition. And I've quoted it before, but it's still considered the definitive study of the last decade on the impact of generosity on the lives of people. It's a book called The Paradox of Generosity by sociologist Christian Smith, who received a $5 million grant to study the science of generosity from Notre Dame University. Quote, it is not a philosophical or a religious conclusion. It is a sociological fact. Those who give receive back in turn. By spending ourselves for others' well-being, we enhance our own standing. In letting go of what we own, we ourselves move toward flourishing. Because there is just almost no downside to being more generous. And so I think it's just a really helpful question to ask ourselves, a question rooted in the scriptures. What is the downside of being more generous? Okay, last one. Here's number three. What's the downside of being more sold out? And here's the groundwork for this question. In Mark's biography of Jesus, chapter 8, Jesus has been doing public ministry for some time, and a crowd is following him, and he wants to explain to them the nature of what it means to follow him. And the text says, verse 34, then Jesus called the crowd to him along with the disciples and said, if anyone would follow me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and come after me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. And now listen to Luke chapter 14. Large crowds were traveling with him, and he turned and said to them, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Now, what point is Jesus making? Because it's not that you should be hostile to your parents. That's not what it is. This was actually a common way in the first century, in the culture then, of expressing ultimate allegiance. If there were two authorities claiming your allegiance, and you said, this is number one and that's number two, another way of saying that in Jesus' day was, you must love the one and hate the other. So this is about living your life sold out to an idea or a cause or a person. And I want to get back to Jesus specifically on this in a second, but I want to talk more generally for a moment about the problem with living a balanced lifestyle, the problem with never fully committing to something or someone outside of yourself. I read the book Great by Choice by Jim Collins when it came out a few years ago. Want to be great? He says balance is not one of the secrets to achieving greatness. I read The Happiness Project by Gretchen Rubin, bestseller when it came out. Want to pursue happiness? Not once does she recommend balance as a key. John Wooden's book, My Personal Best, phenomenal little book. Nowhere does he say your personal best is discovered through balance. And the truth is, as football season is about to start, I don't want Matt Ryan to skip film time or practice so he can work on his recently acquired interest in the shuffleboard. I'm telling you, friends, a little bit of this and a little bit of that lifestyle is vastly overrated. Read a biography of Gandhi or Mother Teresa or Martin Luther King Jr. or John Adams or Nelson Mandela. Read about the most successful and fulfilled and happy athletes and artists. And look at Jesus too. And you'll learn that all these folks, none of them live a little bit of this and a little bit of that balanced life. They're sold out, filled with deeply rooted purpose, which turns out is the basis for their deeply rooted joy. Which is why when Jesus calls us to be all in on his teachings, he's not trying to make you feel guilty or like you don't measure up. He's actually trying to help us experience the deepest kind of joy and love and purpose. This is why in Matthew chapter 13, he teaches that the kingdom of heaven, that life with God, is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought the field. The key, of course, in that story is this phrase, in his joy. He's fist bumping and high fiving folks as he lives the sold out life. Because there is just no downside to being sold out to the ways of Jesus. You know, in Matthew chapter 11, there's this invitation that Jesus makes. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. In other words, the person who has the easiest, the happiest, the strongest life is the person who walks in the yoke with Christ. And what is the yoke of Christ? Well, this language referred to oxen in Jesus' day. It speaks of two animals being strongly yoked together. It's to be radically sold out to the ways of Jesus. And the happiest person is the one who is strongly connected to Jesus. Because I'm telling you, there is just little downside in being sold out to the ways of Jesus. So, what's the downside? What's the downside of being more flexible? What's the downside of being more generous? What's the downside of being more sold out to the ways of Jesus? What's the downside? It's actually one of the Bible's most frequently asked questions, and one I pray we'd consider more often in our day as well. Let's pray. God, I pray that we would leave this teaching with a renewed sense of the wisdom for keeping the main thing, and then being flexible about everything else. a renewed sense of perspective surrounding the joy that comes from being more generous, and a renewed desire to not just live a 50-50 lifestyle, but to be sold out to your ways. And I also pray this morning, God, for every person listening now, because you know what hurdles they're facing, and you know what wonderful plans you have in store for them. And so I pray that they would know your kindness and your presence and your wisdom in their lives as they journey in the days ahead. And TNC, now may the Lord bless you and keep you. Make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace. Amen.